The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Deborah Love for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Health Letter. Our first item is an important one about preparing now for your health needs in the future. The last thing most of us want to face in old age is being unable to take care of ourselves. Unfortunately, it's a likely possibility. At age 65, we have a 70% chance of needing some type of long-term care services and supports in our remaining years. Thinking about it can be unsettling, and planning for it can feel overwhelming. What I see is that most people do very little to prepare. They don't want to talk about it, and their kids don't want to hear about it. Everyone winds up scrambling when a caregiver is needed, says Dr. Susan Salomon, Associate Chief of Gerontology at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. She recommends preparing for potential caregiving needs today while you're healthy and can make your own decisions. To help you begin, we've created the following guide, plus a checklist of important steps. The first thing is get certain legal affairs in order. If you haven't already, it's time to choose the person or people who will one day make decisions for you when you can't, as well as the type of care you'd like. Have a frank conversation with your partner, grown kids, family members, or friends. It's best if they live in your vicinity, but they don't have to. They do need to be reliable and available when you need them, and they must understand what you want, Dr. Salomon says. Will they be able to talk to your banker, attorney, doctors, or hospital and long-term care facility workers? Will they carry out your wishes? Don't limit their decision-making by saying, "Don't put me in a nursing home." You never know what will be best for you. You'll need two legal documents to make your designees official. A power of attorney, designating the person who can make your legal and financial decisions, and a healthcare proxy, designating the person who can make your healthcare decisions. In addition, consider drawing up other advance directives, such as a living will, to clarify your wishes for future care. Seek out an estate attorney to draw up the paperwork or download the forms for free from your state. The AARP offers handy links. Next, learn about housing options. Are you planning to stay in your own home for as long as possible? Are you thinking you'll live with family members? Have you discussed it with them to confirm the option? Or are you figuring you'll move to a retirement facility with independent living, assisted living, or a nursing home? Or all three? A combination described as the continuum of care. Start investigating all of the options, even if you don't think you'll need them. If you plan to age in place at home or live with a relative, the home may need some adjustments. You'll need a bedroom, a bathroom with a walk-in shower, a kitchen, and a door to the outside, preferably all on the same floor. If you have stairs, be sure to have handrails and consider options for installing a stair lift. Make home renovations if necessary as soon as possible. Waiting until the last minute might not be realistic. If you think a retirement facility is in your future, familiarize yourself with local options. Make appointments to visit them and to ask about amenities, costs, the ratio of nurses or health aides to residents, and how often they have availability for new residents. Look up their safety records using the Medicare comparison tool at www.medicare.gov/compare-care. I have some patients who've already moved into independent living facilities with the entire continuum of care. They like the idea of having everything on the same campus, Dr. Salomon says. But other people prefer waiting until it's clear what they need. You might also investigate residential care homes. which have a dozen or fewer residences and a small staff that might live on the premises, and memory care facilities, which are tailored to people with various forms of dementia. Knowing what's available to you in your community will give you a greater ability to make decisions later, if necessary. Dr. Solomon also suggests investigating support services. Whether you live in a private home or a retirement facility, you might still need to hire outside services such as transportation, grocery and pharmacy delivery, or private duty care, which is a companion or health aide. Dr. Solomon recommends learning about those services now before you need them. For example, if you've never ordered groceries for delivery, give it a try. Find out which apps your grocery store uses, such as Instacart, sign up, and get a delivery. Download a transportation app, such as Uber or Lyft, order a ride, and test it out. That will give you a better idea of whether you'll be able to take advantage of those services in the future. If that doesn't seem feasible for you, you'll need to make other arrangements. Contact local private duty care agencies to learn about the levels of care provided by home companions, certified health aides, and nurses. For instance, companions can do anything a friend would do: keep you company, cook, clean, or drive, except help you physically. A health aide can cook, clean, and drive for you and legally lay hands on you, helping you bathe and get in and out of a car. A nurse has specialized training and can take care of wounds and dispense medications. Ask how much these services cost. For instance, the national average starts at $33 per hour and the minimum number of weekly hours required for service. Another option is to contact your local area agency on aging, part of a network of more than 600 agencies that receive federal funding to coordinate older adult support services and provide referrals to them. You can get a free consultation and a personalized list of services in your area that might address your needs, including nonprofit groups that provide free or low-cost services such as meals, transportation, and exercise classes tailored to specific health problems, such as Parkinson's disease. To find your area agency on aging, go to the Federal Elder Care Locator at https://eldercare.acl.gov. Dr. Solomon requires that you start downsizing. Even if you feel you are years away from needing caregiving of some kind, it will help if you can downsize your belongings, and even your home, now. Moving to a smaller home makes sense if it's too large and no longer suits your needs, and if you can cash in some of its value. But you still might want to have enough room for family visits or for a caregiver, if you'll ever need someone to live with you. When my mother downsized, she looked for a two-bedroom condo for that very purpose, Dr. Solomon points out. This might be a good time to start getting recommendations from friends for real estate agents. You'll also need to downsize the contents of your home so they'll fit into a smaller place. This removes a burden from your family. It can be a painful process to try to determine what to do with someone else's treasures. Downsizing is an enormous task that can take months. Consider hiring a professional organizer, costs for that started about $60 an hour, to assist you. If you'd like to try it on your own, Organizing Pros suggest doing it gradually, going through one drawer or room at a time, dividing things into keep, discard, and donate piles, and devoting a set amount of time to the job, such as one day per week. Take breaks so you don't become physically or emotionally exhausted. Our ability to handle stress declines as we get older, Dr. Solomon said. And she recommends getting financial advice. Paying for caregiving is unimaginable for most people. The average assisted living care facility charges $5,900 per month. A semi-private room in a nursing home averages $9,277 per month. Private duty care easily runs over $1,000 per month if you receive 3 hours of care 3 days per week. And Medicare doesn't pay for any of those costs. You must also consider the cost of drugs and equipment you might need, such as wheelchairs or medical beds. Medicare might pay for only a portion of those, Dr. Salomon says. The best way to tackle huge expenses starts with planning. Consider working with a financial planner who can look at your projected income, assets, and expenses and help you come up with creative ways to address costs, such as getting a reverse mortgage, which lets you convert your home equity into cash before you move. If you're a veteran, you might qualify for benefits that pay for part of your private duty care or assisted living facility costs. And though it may seem hard to believe, the time to do all of this is now. It's never too early to start thinking about these costs or the possibility that you'll need caregiving, Dr. Salomon says. We can't predict that it will be necessary, but statistics and health problems, especially major chronic diseases such as heart disease, diabetes, and neurologic conditions, increase your risk. The more you can do now, the better off you'll be later on. And now for her promised preparation checklist. Number one, talk to loved ones about becoming your healthcare proxy and power of attorney. Two, prepare the forms to designate these agents and other advance directives and get them notarized if necessary. Three, assess whether renovations will be needed to age in place at your home or the home of a loved one. Four, if you need renovations, get estimates from at least three local contractors. Five, visit a few assisted living facilities, nursing homes, and residential care homes in your area. Six, try out grocery and transportation apps. Seven, call a few private duty care agencies to find out what services and prices they have. Eight, call the local Area Agency on Aging and schedule a consultation. 9. Start downsizing your belongings. And 10. Make an appointment with a financial planner to discuss strategies to pay for potential caregiving expenses. Now let's take a look at one of the conditions that might necessitate some of those future care needs. Are you at risk for heart failure? New evidence sounds the alarm for millions of U.S. adults. More than 7 million people in the United States struggle with heart failure, a chronic, progressive, life-threatening condition in which the heart doesn't pump as well as it needs to. And more than twice as many might be at risk for developing the condition, according to a study that used new calculations to estimate risk. This is all hands on deck. We already know that heart failure rates are rising, and clinicians need to use the best tools to identify individuals at the highest risk and intervene accordingly, says Dr. James Januzzi, the Hutter Family Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and a cardiologist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. The new tools are called the PREVENT equations. That's PREVENT in all caps, which stands for Predicting Risk of Cardiovascular Disease Events. They were developed by doctors from the American Heart Association, whose work was published by Circulation late in 2023. Like previous methods to predict heart disease, the PREVENT equations consider age, blood pressure, cholesterol levels, and smoking history. But the equations remove race, which proved to be an unreliable predictor, and add more aspects of health, such as body mass index and measures of kidney function and diabetes risk. In a new study, published as a research letter in the January 2025 issue of Annals of Internal Medicine, Scientists tried out the PREVENT equations using the health information of almost 5,000 people who were initially free of heart disease, some of whom subsequently developed heart failure. Based on how participants fared in the calculations, the authors then estimated that about 15 million U.S. adults would have a heart failure risk of at least 10% over the next 10 years. Dr. Januzzi says the estimate of 15 million people at risk for heart failure is higher than expected, but not terribly surprising. Heart failure is often the end stage of any kind of heart disease, and the PREVENT equations include people with every condition that puts you at risk for heart disease, he says. In other words, your risk for heart failure is higher if you already have clogged arteries, atherosclerosis, a heart valve problem, an abnormal heart rhythm, such as atrial fibrillation, or a history of heart attack. Your risk might also be elevated because you have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, kidney disease, diabetes or obesity, or because of lifestyle factors such as alcohol or drug misuse, smoking, or a lack of exercise. Older age and family history also increase the risk for heart failure. So, how would you spot it? Heart failure is tricky to catch and can go undiagnosed for years. The condition reduces blood flow to tissues and organs. They don't get enough oxygen and you tire easily. Or your body responds to the reduced blood flow by retaining salt and fluid, which accumulates in your legs and abdomen, causing them to swell. It also accumulates in the lungs, causing breathlessness. Symptoms like these can be brushed off as consequences of being older, out of shape, or overweight. While they do not always indicate impending heart failure, they're worth discussing with your doctor. To diagnose heart failure, doctors typically conduct a physical exam and order an electrocardiogram, or an ECG, and a chest X-ray to look for fluid in the lungs. You may have a blood test to look for naturopathic peptides, substances released by the heart at earliest stages of heart failure. The test is widely available and simple to analyze. The result is a strong predictor for heart failure. If it were more widely applied, we'd be able to identify heart failure risk more efficiently, Dr. Januzzi says. You may also have an ultrasound of the heart to determine its size, structure, and ability to pump. If you do have heart failure, your doctor will determine what type you have. The key distinction relates to ejection fraction, a measure that reflects the heart's ability to pump out blood. A normal heart fills fully with blood and then forcefully pumps most of it out to the body. Some people with heart failure have what's called a reduced ejection fraction. Their heart fills with blood normally, but it pumps out too little due to a weak left ventricle, the heart's main pumping chamber. Increasingly, doctors are seeing heart failure with a preserved ejection fraction. The heart can pump forcefully, but it doesn't fill with blood properly in the first place because the muscle is becoming stiff. It's more common than we thought, Dr. Januzzi says. Current estimates suggest half of people with heart failure have it, but it could be more. Fortunately, we have many medications that lower heart failure complications and extend life. Here's what you can do. If you're concerned about heart failure risk, ask your doctor about the PREVENT calculator, a free online tool. You might need updated blood tests to fill out all the variables in the equation. If you have conditions known to contribute to heart failure, try to get them under control and try to maintain a healthy lifestyle with lots of exercise, sleep, a healthy diet, moderate, if any, drinking, no smoking, and stress management practices such as meditation. This next article asks whether diverticulitis can heal on its own. Your doctor spotted diverticula in a previous colonoscopy, but you never thought the little pouches in your large intestine or colon would turn into little devils. Now pain in your gut is telling you something is wrong. Do you have diverticulitis? And will it get better without medical care? First, how it happens. Diverticula develop when weak spots in the colon lining bulge outward, creating little pouches or potholes. They more often form in the sigmoid colon, which runs down the left side of the pelvis and then joins the rectum. Most people never have a problem with them. They're extremely common. They are present in about 70% of us by age 80, says Dr. Alexander Goldowski, a gastroenterologist at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. But sometimes diverticula bleed, or they become inflamed or infected, a condition called diverticulitis. Diverticulitis tends to cause pain in the lower part of your abdomen. It's not typical tummy trouble. It's a different kind of pain that can be significant and severe, Dr. Goldowski says. Although diverticula rarely cause symptoms, diverticulitis can cause bloating, diarrhea, constipation, or blood in your stool. If a diverticulum is infected, you might have fever, chills, or vomiting in addition to pain. If it's the first time you've had this kind of pain, reach out to your doctor right away, Dr. Goldowski says. If you have a history of diverticulitis and you develop mild symptoms, let your doctor know. He or she may just recommend temporary dietary changes and taking it easy. But if things aren't improving, call your doctor again. Don't put off calling. An infected diverticulum can form an abscess, which is a pus-filled pocket, that can extend to other tissue in the body and become life-threatening. In rare cases, that new colon pain may indicate cancer. As for diagnosis, after you've alerted your doctor about gut pain, you'll need to go in for a physical exam. This exam can involve checking your abdomen for tenderness and the rectum for signs of blood. You might need blood and stool tests. But the main way to diagnose diverticulitis is with a CT scan, typically after a special type of contrast dye is injected into your vein. If we see inflammation surrounding one of the divertica, we can determine that you have diverticulitis, Dr. Goldowski says. So, can diverticulitis heal on its own? Yes, it can. And for that reason, we don't always prescribe antibiotics. We reserve them for diverticulitis in people with an abscess, a significant amount of inflammation, symptoms that aren't improving, a suppressed immune system, frailty, or other health problems, such as liver or kidney disease, Dr. Koldowski says. Care at home, with or without an antibiotic, includes rest, a clear liquid diet, and acetaminophen, which is Tylenol, for pain. You might want to avoid non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs or NSAIDs, such as ibuprofen, known as Advil or Motrin, which can add to gastrointestinal discomfort. For severe diverticulitis, you might need to be hospitalized for a few days, getting antibiotics directly into a vein. If you have an abscess, you might need surgery to clean out the infection. Getting better. Healing from diverticulitis requires commitment. If you're taking an oral antibiotic, make sure you stick to the medication schedule. If you're on a liquid diet, avoid cheating. Once symptoms begin improving, you can move to a low-fiber diet. It includes animal protein, such as eggs, cheese, fish, and poultry, certain cooked vegetables, carrots, green beans, potatoes, pumpkin, yams, or squash, low-fiber fruits, such as bananas, peaches, and pears, and if your doctor says it's okay, low-fiber breads, such as white sourdough or refined wheat breads. Stay away from spicy, fatty foods and alcohol. If you feel up to it, it's okay to exercise, but go easy on yourself. Avoid abdominal exercise. Go for a walk or do some arm exercises with small dumbbells, Dr. Goldowski says. If you feel uncomfortable, take a break and buckle in. It could be 10 days before your symptoms go away completely. So, what's that liquid diet for diverticulitis? You might need a clear liquid diet to give your colon a break from digesting solid foods. A liquid diet can include clear drinks and foods such as water, broth, or bouillon, black tea, plain tea, clear juice such as apple or white grape, clear soft drinks or sports drinks, Jell-O or popsicles. There's no need to stay on a liquid diet for more than 48 hours unless recommended by your doctor. And now, that morning coffee habit might be linked to a longer life. If you are an all-day coffee drinker, or are you a morning Joe kind of person, the timing of your Java fix might affect your longevity, according to a study published online January 8, 2025, by the European Heart Journal. Scientists at Harvard and other institutions evaluated the self-reported dietary habits of more than 40,000 adults in the United States who were followed for about a decade. Researchers found two distinct patterns among participants, either morning or all-day coffee drinking. Compared with people who didn't drink any coffee, those who drank in the morning were 16% less likely to die for any reason during the study period, and 31% less likely to die from cardiovascular disease, with the greatest benefits coming from consuming at least two cups. There weren't any risk reductions among those who drank coffee throughout the day compared with those who didn't drink coffee. The study was observational and doesn't prove conclusively that the morning coffee drinking pattern has more health benefits than the all-day habit. However, the authors speculate that anti-inflammatory chemicals in coffee might be most beneficial in a concentrated amount in the morning, when inflammation levels are typically highest, rather than smaller amounts spread throughout the day as inflammation levels fall. Well, that's all we have time for today. I invite you to join us next week. Once again, I'll be reading from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, and we'll be talking about, among other things, jaw pain and hair loss. Be sure to listen next time, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Deborah Love, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. I'd especially be interested to know if there are particular diseases or health issues you'd like to know more about. That way I can keep an eye out for them in subsequent episodes. That number again is 919-832-5138. Again, this is Deborah Love, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.